Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of May 15th, 2022. As if you've been following along, you'll know that we are in the process of posting, cross-posting podcasts from a website called Franklin Matters with my friend and host, Steve Sherlock. What we've been talking about is the ongoing saga, the challenge, the decade-long program of implementing the Massachusetts Next Generation Roadmap for Climate, which is a comprehensive document about how the state will address climate change. And, of course, the big question is, how are we doing it? What other things do we need to implement? All that kind of interesting stuff. Anyhow, this is the fifth show in the series. It was originally posted on March 15th, 2022, and I hope you enjoy it. Fighting communism was the organizing principle of our politics. I would say if you fast forward to the present day, climate change has to be the organizing principle of our politics, right? Mm. And that's how you align all the different groups. And even in Massachusetts, if climate change is the organizing principle of our politics, then slowly all of the bureaucracies in the state, from the DPU to the MBTA to the energy and environment, all that stuff slowly aligns to the same goal, because we're all operating saying that everything has to be, every policy has to be viewed in the context of the climate roadmap.
Steve Sherlock here for Franklin Matters, Franklin Public Radio, anywhere on the internet at WFPR.FM and in the local Franklin, Mass area dial at 102.9 on the FM band. Here today for another Making Sense of Climate with my expert guide, Ted McIntyre. Ted, happy day to you.
Steve, how you doing? I should say, since we're in a Irish mood, top of the morning, and I hope you put the green dye in your coffee so that it's...
Well, yesterday was pie day, and since I hadn't made pie or my French meat pies at New Year's, I did some meat pie baking. And then there's this Ides of March, so I'm not going to go stabbing anybody. There's a lot of things happening.
That's right. Always is, huh?
Always is. And particularly in the climate space. I mean, where do we begin? Yeah. Well, let's begin, I think, in terms of kind of the flow as we've been developing. We'll give a quick look back what did happen since we last talked, and kind of what's coming, to give some teasers in case people want to do some stuff in the next couple of weeks or so, and then do a deep dive somewhere along the way and see where that goes.
That sounds like a plan to me.
So fasten your seatbelts, folks. Thank you for listening. And we'll put a plug in now as well as at the end. If you've got any particular topics that you'd like us to discuss along the way, feel free to drop us a line. The info will be in the show notes. If it's not already all over Franklin Matters, you should be able to find out. And Ted certainly has a couple of other places on the interwebs, so you can Google him or find him somewhere and get in touch with us.
That's right. All of the discussion that we have is usually most conveniently framed around this famous roadmap for the 2030 and 2050 roadmaps, right, that Massachusetts has set out for itself, which is basically, you know, big picture plans about how to reduce our carbon emissions and setting goals and goals to get to carbon reductions by the year 2030 and 2050. The carbon reductions, of course, being mostly burning fossil fuels, right? So that's the 30,000 foot level, and you quickly devolve down into much more mundane and specific things that you're trying to do. Just in passing, one of the things that the state is trying to do is to increase the amount of clean energy that's available to the state, right? And this takes years to get cranked up, right? And 2030 now is only 8 years away. So when you're talking about developing things like wind turbines, takes a couple of years anyway, right, to do that sort of thing. And so what has happened recently is that the Massachusetts House of Representatives has passed an aggressive bill to give to support the wind industry. That is to say, to put everything in place so that people who build windmills can give jobs, have the money to get connected to the offshore locations, et cetera, et cetera. That has passed the House, which is just a sort of a baby step on the way to becoming a bill. I'll remind you of the was from the 1980s about how a bill becomes a law. I'm just a bill, right? So there's a lot of long way to go. We'll come back to it. But that did happen this week. We took a baby step forward, a good bill got out of the House. It's headed over to the Senate. Senate has big plans as well. So we'll see what happens with that. Another interesting thing in the same vein. So one of the other things the roadmap wants to address are the big climate plan, the roadmap plan, talks about getting small communities that have their own utilities to become more green. And so these are the municipal light plants, and there are some 41 of them in different towns around the state. The roadmap calls for them to become more green, that get more of their electricity from green sources over the coming decades. And again, that all then spirals down to a particular proposal for a plant up in Peabody that these municipal light plants are trying to build. It's another fossil fuel infrastructure. Again, the buzzword here being fossil fuel infrastructure is some big building that you pay $85 million to build. It's going to burn fossil fuel. That infrastructure is going to be there for 30 to 50 years. Right? Mm-hmm. So you get, and there's a report, the Massachusetts Climate Action Network has caused to be generated some reports that basically talk about how this peaker plant in Peabody is financially not wise. And again, we don't have to go into all the details now, but that's a connection that has happened. And there will be opportunities. We'll put them in the show notes. Opportunities, I think it's March 22nd. There'll be a standout up in Peabody if people want to drive up there and take part in that. Another thing that happened this past week was an observation about transportation, which is quite interesting, which I think is, again, something to talk about, relates to the roadmap, the famous roadmap, because the roadmap wants to reduce the carbon dioxide emissions from transportation. And again, these are buzzwords. Transportation means your car, right? But it also means the MBTA and the buses that all drive around.
Yep. And the regional transit organizations are.
Regional transit organizations, yes.
GATRA in the Franklin area in particular.
Right, which is. And so the nice thing about the mass transit is that they all, the buses, the trains, they all go back home and sleep at night, like Thomas the Tank Engine in the big roundhouse, right? Yep. That's a place they could all be easily recharged, right? If they were electric, they go home and get refilled with gasoline every night. Well, why not bring them home and fill them with electricity every night? So basically the idea is the electrification of mass transit. Mm-hmm. Would be a real boon to the roadmap, because all the trains that come into Franklin, right? There's trains going everywhere. There's buses driving all around. Anyway, long and short of it is, the MBTA is a big bureaucratic organization driven by financial, the bottom line. And there's a long, painful history around how much burden has been put on the MBTA. In so many words, the big dig, right, for all the automobiles that are their own weird form of mass transit, the big dig building the Tip O'Neill Tunnel, all that $15 billion got dropped on the MBTA to pay off. So all of a sudden, all of the train services are burdened by this debt for a new tunnel named after Tip O'Neill. It's like, okay, that was not fair, but put that aside. Anyway, long and short of it, MBTA wants to electrify, but they say, oh, we can't quite get that bus charger in here for 15 years, which I think, Steve, correct me if I'm wrong, did not set well with people in the Senate who said, no. Yeah. The Massachusetts Senate said, hey, 15 years is too long. Let's talk some, right? What was that story?
Yeah, because clearly as the MBTA, and I think there was a couple of articles on this, the MBTA and their budget projections, capital planning, et cetera, started touting, to your point, that they were going to delay the introduction of the batteries, electrification, et cetera. And that obviously went, wait a minute, we were on this roadmap. We're not supposed to be like bumper cars bumping against the walls all the place. We're supposed to be kind of on the track, everybody aligned in getting to the goals. And yet MBTA, amongst others, because we've talked in some of the other conversations where, wait a minute, I thought that was, so MBTA is a recent one where they seem to be deviating from the master plan. And fortunately, the Senate, at least they still have an opportunity to do some stuff on that side. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah, I think the point of encouraging the MBTA to electrify everything, right? It's going to be expensive, right? And it would take some time and thought, but this is a good thing to do. I mean, because it raises so many questions. So mass transit, we were speaking before, mass transit is so Mayor Wu in Boston has made some of the buses free.
Okay? Yes.
There are certain bus routes that are now free in Boston as an experiment, 2-year-long experiment.
Mm-hmm.
And these, of course, are diesel buses, yada, yada, yada. Maybe they have a bus lane they can go on now. But I mean, the idea of making transit free flips some people out, right?
Yeah.
Free buses. Like, why should those people get to ride the bus for free? Why am I paying for them to, right? Which is actually a very human reaction, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if you step back and take a deep breath, you imagine that mass transit, that is to say, all the trains and getting around Boston, is a common public good, right? That you can at least make the case that should be free, because that makes Boston a better city, makes everything actually work better, right? The buses go faster, people can get to their jobs easier, et cetera, et cetera. And so, you know, electrifying the MBTA is one issue, right? But mm-hmm. it's part and parcel of recognizing that the transit system that Boston has needs to be to keep growing. And one venue that I particularly like is the idea of making the mass transit free, because it's a common good that makes Boston a more economically viable city. It benefits everyone in ways that are not just, I don't have an extra quarter for the bus, so I can't go to work today. But there you go. I mean, it's so Mayor, I guess where I started was that Mayor Wu has made some of the routes free. The ridership has increased. And that's a good thing from a climate perspective, because it means fewer people are driving cars. Right? And it's just that the whole question of transit and climate, you can talk about it in the context of Boston, because we do have a roadmap, or Massachusetts generally. We do have a roadmap. Mm-hmm. We do have plans. And then all of a sudden, once you have a plan, you can look at the MBTA and the transit, various transit organizations, and say, oh, there are good changes that we can make that are useful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it touches into one of the economic justice points of the master plan overall. So if you're making the bus in this pilot, 2 or 3 routes, I forget exactly how many it is, but that's not necessarily the point. The point that it is much more accessible and ridership has gone up. So they're already asking, is the schedule frequent enough? Maybe we should change the schedule to accommodate the increase in ridership, which is all good, because clearly the benefits, other than those people are now getting to work, so they're earning some money theoretically and thereby able to better sustain a house, which sets that entire cycle going. But in so doing, there's less cars on the road, so there should be less traffic, less pollution, da 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 da, etc. that's the climate impact as well. Never mind kind of the benefit to the overall quality of life. Now you've got people who are enabled to provide a working wage, hopefully, or at least a wage to help their lifestyle. So there's lots of things in there, and it depends upon, you know, exactly where you want to draw the line, but it's within the realm and thereby should be that public good. And we have to realize, and we haven't really said it here, but in so many ways, cars have been subsidized for so many, many years. Oh my God, we might as well start subsidizing the mass transit to really diminish the use of the car. And even in the local Franklin arena, as we start doing this Franklin for All study, the discussion around how much parking we require for businesses downtown, as opposed to making it much more walkable, right? How far do you walk? How far do you get around? Right.
I completely agree. And I think that the when we talk about the Franklin proposal, right, and the question is how much parking would you have downtown? I suggest you have to think 50 years out. Mm-hmm. Right? What we're, and so in 50 years, I guarantee you, there'll be, you know, we'll all be driving around in electric Segways or little scooters. People have many, many different options other than driving their, you know, big car and looking for a parking place behind the Citizens Bank kind of thing. Right.
Right.
Just, so yes. And it's also part and parcel of how you plan the city. So yeah, it's an amazing amount of interconnections when you start talking about transit and what else it touches.
Yeah. And it's touched as well, because one of the state issues coincidentally goes back to the MBTA, where the state has initiatives. We also have a housing issue, housing crisis. It lets incent more housing closer to the transit stop. So MBTA transit stations, of which Franklin has two, is tied in with that. So now we start looking at zoning, and now we start looking at, instead of having kind of a suburban development, you know, just, you know, rows of cookie cutter houses, or in our cases, maybe more kind of the McDonald type mansions in some cases, but just all, they're totally only accessible via cars. You can't really walk from there anywhere. Maybe redesign that zone so that you could have in some sort of the center kind of the old neighborhood concept that many of us grew up with, where you could walk to the corner store. There was a gas station nearby. There was some sort of service, whether it was a barbershop, you know, drugstore or whatever. The neighborhoods were much more walkable, and thereby having those, maybe then you need less cars to the point, go into the Stop and Shop plazas, et cetera, for the big trips. They would be much less frequent.
No, you're completely right. And I guess it's, again, keep marveling at how you can tie local zoning decisions to mm-hmm. a global climate issue, right? They're all connected, right? Yeah. It's how you zone a place impacts what transit is going to be applicable in that. So, yeah, I mean, it's really, one of the, since we're on the question of transit, people should know that in Massachusetts, in the New England region, there was an effort to make something called the Transportation Climate Initiative, Transportation and Climate Initiative, a TCI, which was an effort to try to basically put a fee on gasoline in order to fund some of this other work of fixing the transportation system. That essentially crashed and burned for various reasons but basically it's kind of a dead letter right now, which is mm-hmm. not a good thing. But what it does is, in the aftermath of losing that, we still need to find a way to deal with the transportation. And so we're back to, can we electrify the buses in Boston and all of the trolley cars, yada, yada, yada. And I think it turns out I kind of like transportation issues, strangely enough. But I heard it said one time that, so everyone should know that there is a proposal to bring a train from Boston to Springfield.
Right. Right. Well, it's been talked of almost as long as there's been proposals, I think, to unify North Station and South Station.
Exactly right. And bring a train down to my homestead of New Bedford, right? Yeah. And what does that involve? That involves, you know, fighting with every town about the noise, getting the rights of ways back mm-hmm. and forth, round and round. So that's what things delay. Just to challenge, just to put a crazy idea into the zeitgeist here. I mean, it would seem possible to have a luxury electric bus that carries 25 people in reclining benches, served by somebody handing out hot towels, that would depart South Station every 20 minutes to go to Springfield, right? In some mm-hmm. perfect world, with a dedicated lane going down the Mass Pike, get you out there in an hour. That's going to happen way, way in advance of a rail link. And so the idea of big electric buses electrifying all these things is a great idea. And it's a way to go that allows us the time to think about how to build, you know, a magnetic levitation train from mm-hmm. the substation to Springfield.
Right. Or who is it? Elon Musk with one of his tunnel concepts. You know, maybe one of those would work too. So
yeah. We could have a yes. Well, there you go. So anyway, the transit stuff is quite interesting from a climate perspective. There's lots of dimensions to it, and it's very important, something to think about. And it all, again, relates back to this roadmap question of how are we going to decarbonize ourselves by 2030 and fully by 2050. It takes time to start thinking about that stuff, isn't mm-hmm. it?
Yeah, because for many of the folks who are in Franklin, one of the key reasons they located here was similar to, you know, my location here many years ago it was certainly along 495. So I was centrally located. I could get somewhere by car if I needed, but primarily the train to Boston. Yep. You know, so I rode the train 4 or 5 days a week for multiple years. And it was, granted, it was an hour plus, depending upon the schedule and or what was happening. But it gave me three things I could do that I couldn't do in a car. I could pull my head back and take a quick nap if I needed to. I could open my laptop and be productive, or I could read a book. And I read an awful lot of books in the meantime. So
I had someone described to me one time that they put an electrocardiogram kind of heart monitor on somebody, and they put one guy on a train and the other person to drive to the same mm-hmm. location.
Oh, sure.
And the person on the train was just quiet and calm for an hour, whereas the person driving who had these adrenaline spikes as they saw the red lights and whatnot.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. It gave you a chance to decompress from work before you walked into whatever was going on in the home door. In that other world. And that's where we try to bring some things back into kind of, oh, okay, this is a big issue. We're not going to boil the ocean, but there needs to be something we individually can do. And I think there's a couple of topics in there that, you know, that are interesting. Some we can do today, some we're going to be able to do fairly soon.
This comes back to the roadmap. So one of the aspects of the roadmap, the big Massachusetts roadmap, that's the context for everything we talk about, wants to decarbonize houses, mm-hmm. right? They want to, now what is decarbonize your home? Again, buzzwords that you get used to after a while, but what you want to do is stop using fossil fuel to run your home. And what do you do to, for example, I use natural gas to heat the space, to heat my water, mm-hmm. to dry my clothes, and to cook my food. I mean, that's a lot. And if it you is. Can find a way to get out of that loop where you're losing, getting rid of the gas, that's the decarbonization point, right? Your house is not emitting so much. So that's fine. One of the, I guess, most psychologically powerful things in your home is the kitchen, the stove. People like to cook with gas, right? People like that blue flame. It's everyone likes it. People swear by it. People will, you know, argue in favor of gas cooking. It won't go down the path that says we've been sold a lot of that concept by the gas industry, right? Clean natural gas. I mean, how many years have they been banging on you to say that kind of stuff?
Right.
But people, and you get used to it. I have been used to cooking food with gas for a long time. But there are a couple articles in the New York Times this past weekend that pertain to cooking as sort of the thin edge of the wedge to decarbonize your home, right? Because if you can find a way to cook your food without using gas, you're better off, right? For a couple of reasons, because there are also studies out there nowadays that say that stove in the kitchen is emitting gas even when it's not on. Like when you turn the knob and the gas hasn't quite caught yet, there's still gas coming into your house. Right. Some places leaking small amounts of gas that don't quite get to your nose level, but is leaking all the time. So there are, and when you burn that gas, you know, it gives your kid asthma because it's making pollution in your kitchen, yada, yada, yada. So what can you do? So there's reasons to get rid of the gas cooking for climate and health reasons, but it turns out there's this technology called an induction cooking, which I have come to be a big fan of. As one of the articles says, it's the darling of the green movement. So what's induction cooking? So it turns out, it's really interesting. You can buy what looks like a hot plate for less than $100, right? You can go to Amazon, you can buy an induction. I think Duck's Top is the one I bought, $100. Inside that hot plate, it's got a glass cover on it, a glass top on it that you put your pan on. Inside of it is this funny electromagnetic field that you turn on, sort of akin to a microwave, but not quite the same thing. Like, you've got a microwave, you're used to the idea of electromagnetic radiation heating your food. Well, this does it in a slightly different way, but it's electromagnetic. And the magic is that nothing gets hot except the pan. Right. So in order that this induction cooktop you can buy, of course, you can get induction ranges. We can talk about that. But if you get, and you have to have a special pan that's magnetic. So it turns out that if you go into your kitchen, take that magnet off the refrigerator, right? Just take a refrigerator magnet and see if it grabs the bottom of any of your cook pots. And it does on one of them, then you have an induction-compatible cookpot. So it's not magic, right? Typically, the copper-coated things are not magnetically. But you have this pan. And what happens is that the induction cooktop literally induces heat into the pan itself, right? So now, as opposed to the gas cooktop where you've got the flame that's hot, right, will light your house on fire all by itself, right? And you're applying that heat to the pan. This thing is, the pan gets hot, nothing else. And if you take the pan off the cooktop, basically the transfer of energy stops, right? And there's a little warning, the cooktop might get hot because of the reflected heat from the pan, but the cooktop itself is not hot, which is fascinating. Right? And it turns out that for me, the induction cooktop is just better. It's more precise. It doesn't burn stuff the way gas can, right? It takes a little getting used to. It takes a couple of weeks to figure out how to use it, right? There's no doubt it's a change, right? Mm-hmm. But it's not a scary change. And at the end of the day, you've got a better device for cooking. It's just remarkable. So these articles in the New York Times basically tout how good the heater is, how good the induction stove is. And the one that since I make oatmeal every morning on my cooktop, on my induction, right? This article says, my induction stove is so cool. I can set the pan to be held constant at 209 degrees. Remember, boiling is 212 degrees.
Correct.
So he says, I set my oatmeal to 209 degrees and it never boils over. Like it used to boil over on the gas stove and get all junked up in the 209 degrees never boils because it's always below boiling, but it cooks perfectly and it's electronically controlled. I mean, you set that temperature and it's a wonderful thing. Now the downside, if you want to have your whole kitchen changed over to an induction cooktop, okay. So I had a friend who's wanted to do that. They wanted, you know, a four burner setup where they have all the cooking, just like replace their gas cooktop. Okay. If you do that, then you will most likely need a 240 volt electrical plug
So a different service.
Different service, which oftentimes can be expensive, depending on the exact setup of your home.
You've already been wired. Yeah.
If you've already been wired, you're lucky. But if you want to have that put in, it can be, again, depending on, and if you want to put in, so 240 volts, what does that mean? 240 volts has much more power than in the 120 volt.
Sure.
Right. So this is the big three prong guys, right? You need more power to be cooking. And so that something you have to deal with, should be aware of, but you can still buy these little 120 volt cooktop things that, so now I have three cooktops that I, so I'm there cooking, and what's crazy, you can put it on the countertop, right? And just kind of cook closer. And it's not, I don't know, it's a good thing. I highly recommend people, if you're thinking about it, go check it out. Now, I think that under the new Mass Save rule, so again, come back to the roadmap, this organization called Mass Save wants to come help you decarbonize your home.
Right.
They've recently changed the rules, and I would not be surprised if there are within that some offerings to help you maybe redo the electrical stuff in your home, maybe get some money for the induction cooking, because it's not particularly cheap at the stovetop level.
Right.
But I mean, yeah. Homes are going to need, as we go with more electric vehicles, you're going to need a 240 volt hookup anyway, because your car wants that. So it's an opportunity to, I think you were saying before how the MBTA is headed off in one direction and the roadmap is heading in another direction. And I think one of the lessons that we see from all of this roadmap stuff is how the state government needs to be aligned around the roadmap.
Yes.
The MBTA has to have the same goals as the roadmap. The Mass Save program, decarbonizing the homes, has to recognize that people need help to do this. Right? These are all things that you can, as a climate activist, you can be asking for the alignment of the entire state government towards this thing, so we're not having organizations fighting each other.
No. Go back to the bumper car analogy before. We certainly don't want to be in a bumper car hitting against the walls on each side going, that's not very efficient, never mind dangerous. And picking up on another mass type thing people will recognize is the crew races that generally happen on the Charles, which is also a nice thing to happen. And on the Eight Sculls, if they're all rowing in sync, that's great. Heaven forbid one slips that oar. What happens? That boat doesn't go very far or fast or well. Yeah,
we are. It needs to be a team approach. And that's a great analogy.
Yes. And we won't go political. We'll just mention a little bit aside, because there's some senator who lives in a very fossil state that is apparently against some electrification of cars and stuff. And follow the money, folks. We'll do no more political than that. Just follow the money.
Yes, he who shall not be named. But speaking of people, evil people in the world, I got a different topic that I find interesting. And it connects local action, our roadmap here in Massachusetts, all the way up to global issues of global security. Of course, I'm talking about the events in Ukraine.
Right.
And I guess one of the things I wanted to do is to make a case that is alternate to what you're probably going to see on TV. And I hope poke a few holes in the conventional wisdom. So, of course, everyone's familiar with what's going on in Ukraine and how they've got a 40-mile-long convoy stuck someplace in between Kiev and the border and yada, yada, yada. And everyone, you keep hearing on TV requests for a no-fly zone, that the United States should somehow put planes in the air over Ukraine and defend the Ukrainians from various kinds of attacks. Very emotionally satisfying. not, you know, there's a joke about everyone was an epidemiologist until 3 weeks ago, and now we're all security analysts, right?
Yes.
But in my humble opinion, I think that putting American planes in the air over Ukraine is an invitation to war, right? So let's just, the point being, though, the reason I'm on it is because the people that are calling for a no-fly zone don't seem to be recognizing a weapon that they have in their own hand to defend Ukraine and attack Putin. And that is to say the following thing. I checked before we get on. It turns out that even today, right, with this war going on in Ukraine, there's about $500 million a day going to Putin to pay for natural gas that gets pumped into Europe. Mm-hmm. Right, to keep their homes warm and yada yada, all the good, cook their food. They don't have induction stoves yet, are they? Right. The natural gas going into the European Union to the tune of $500 million a day that then bucks up the military that's attacking Ukraine and is a leverage point that Putin can threaten Europe and the United States with. Mm-hmm. The president has done. Has symbolically cut off American import of Russian oil. But an important point to know is the following, is that the global oil supply chain, right? So stay with me here. The global oil supply chain is basically 100% at capacity. Okay. Every drop of oil that comes up is used. Mm-hmm. And of course they can ramp up production and ramp down production, but that takes time, blah, 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 blah. So that any disruption, even of a few percent, ripples through the entire world. And why does it ripple through the entire world? Because the energy traders are worried about what's going to happen in 3 weeks, and they're going to bid up the contract for the oil that's on a tanker crossing the Atlantic. Point being that while you see spikes in gasoline, it's not because of the supply, it's because of the market fear, yada, yada, yada. So, but of course, what happens is the prices spike, the fossil fuel industry jumps up and down and says, oh, we must drill for more oil. Look, we need more oil to combat Putin, right? Let's restart the Keystone XL pipeline. Why is the president cutting us off at the knees and not letting us have more gasoline, right? Again, Keystone XL pipeline, you probably hear about, would not have any impact, you know, for 5 years, and it was also designed for exports. It wasn't to help us. Right. I mean, there are already thousands of, like, I think it's like 9,000 parcels of lots that have already been leased for the oil industry to go drill on. So if they want to drill, they can go drill today, right? They don't need any action from the federal government.
Underutilized capacity exists.
Underutilized. And so this whole thing is a scam. And what it relates to is something called the shock doctrine. So Naomi Klein is an author, she's a Canadian author, wrote a book called The Shock Doctrine, which is basically the idea, and they're quoting, I think, Milton Friedman, who is a very conservative economist from the 1950s, who's saying that when a catastrophe happens, you want to be ready with a plan, right? And so this plan, for example, when the Soviet Union collapsed, all the Western economists ran in and said, privatize everything. Right, that's the way, free markets, privatize everything. They had a plan in place. There's a crisis in Ukraine. Fossil fuel industry says, oh, the plan is to drill more gas. That's what we need. We need more gas. Mm-hmm. I would say there's an alternate plan that the United States can do. And finally, there's a green alternate of something that could be immediately done, which is to help Europe get off fossil fuels. How would you do that? By having President Biden use the Defense Production Act to mandate the production of heat pumps, which then all get put on a plane and brought over to Europe. And between now and next November, we install as many heat pumps as we can in Europe and Ukraine to reduce their dependence on the natural gas that's coming in. And that hurts Putin. Mm-hmm. Right? Similarly, here in the United States, the people that are calling for a no-fly zone should just drive their F-150 trucks a little bit less, right? Instead of crying about gasoline prices, you know, why did you buy a truck that takes a 50-gallon tank?
Right? So it only uses 10 gallons a mile.
It does 10 gallons a mile, right? So it's the most potent weapon against Putin is green technology. and that the United States could, and the reason that the green technology is important is because the global markets are so saturated. The idea that the United States is going to outproduce and, you know, make a lot more gasoline or natural gas, and that's going to solve the problem. No, never going to happen. We need to have green technology. As somebody tweeted, the cost of the sunlight, the cost of solar power today is the same as the solar power was yesterday, right? Hasn't gone up because the traders can't trade on it. And so the case I would make is when you hear stuff on TV about how we must produce more gasoline and the federal government is negligent in not allowing more drilling, That's a hoax. That's misguided. The real thing that we need to be doing, and that every American can do if they really support Ukraine, is to cut down on their fossil fuel consumption, so that they, you know, Putin has less leverage over the EU, and he has less money to spend on bombs, on what do they call them, thermobaric devices or something.
Yes. Yeah, that's
my impassion. Does that make sense to you? You tell me. Did that come? Did I go too far down the rabbit hole with some of the?
I don't think so. And to your point, I think there was a media question at one of the White House press conferences, and there was a clip of Jen Psaki, the spokesperson, who to that point said, and she just rattled off. You know, there's existing the Keystone XL doesn't apply. There's existing lease drill heads that are not even utilized yet. So you've already got excess capacity. We don't need to increase it, without even getting into the next level of detail in terms of, from what I've been reading, there's a mix, and clearly we're more gasoline based than diesel. Europe is the other way. They're more diesel and gasoline. So we would have to mix, never mind the nature of the raw materials. Certainly the certain crudes are much more easily refined the way the refineries in the U.S. are set up. So even if we were to get more from another area, we would have to retrofit our own refineries in order to utilize them. So in terms of, is it going to solve us today? No, it's going to take some time to get there. And oh, by the way, would the capacity that they're authorizing today solve us today? No, we've already got these other permits already approved that they have not yet utilized. So it's not going to solve us today. All these are distractions. And yeah, that's where hopefully in our making sense discussions, we can try and bring it back to, okay, how do you really want to do something? Stop using your own oil. Stop driving, do the little bits. And oh, by the way, talk to the others, talk to your neighbors, talk to your friends. And there's some
I think
concert in action there that can help over time.
Man, I think it's an important point that you're saying is that even if you, the big knock on renewable energy or the heat pump idea, heat pumps to Europe, right? You say, oh, that's going to take a year. Well, every idea on the fossil fuel front is going to take a year as well, right?
Or longer.
As you say, or longer, right? And so you know, just start down the right path now. I would say one other thing that I would want people to be aware of is that because of the nature of the market, as I mentioned, that the supply hasn't changed, but the prices have gone up because the traders are looking 2 or 3 months out and buying gasoline, you know, buying options to buy gasoline in 2 or 3 months.
Basically,
Exxon and the people who sell you the gasoline for your car are gouging you. They're raising prices under the pretense that, oh, there's this shortage, right? They're making a buck. And I would say sort of an unpatriotic way, they're making a buck under the guise of Ukraine. And Sheldon Whitehouse has passed a law to tax, a windfall. He didn't pass a law. He's proposed a bill, right, to tax windfall profits. So again, you look at the culprits here are the people like the big corporations like Exxon and blah, 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 that are taking advantage of the opportunity to charge you more. And they're going to keep doing that until somebody steps in and tells them to stop doing it. And again, it just adds to this sense that we're not doing all we could to really, in my sense, that we're not doing what we could to help in Ukraine. in the most pragmatic and realistic way. This is, and of course, that whole conversation says nothing about climate, right? This would be the what I just said would be true even if using heat pumps didn't save the planet from destruction, right? It would still be a good thing to do. So the nexus of security and climate, I think, is one of the interesting things that's fallen out of this whole Ukrainian thing. It's all of a sudden we see petroleum, fossil fuel stuff as a security issue. Forget climate.
Yeah. And I think the other piece, and maybe effect of certainly the media and the generation who is now at least reporting on the media, we unfortunately have some experience to remember back to the oil crisis back in the mid 70s. And shortly after that, or during that period, there was, I recall, a chart that showed the timeline from oil at the well coming up as raw crude by the time it got to your gas pump, right? It was a significant period of time. So yeah, all of a sudden, the prices have spiked, you know, from 2.25 to, in some cases, over $5. That's not oil that has still to come to us. That's stuff that literally was in the pipeline. So yeah, to your point, it is gouging. They're taking advantage of it. And we're paying for it until somehow we can get them to adjust their process. Right. But we need, and one of the things that in terms of our making sense of climate, we also need to be aware of who's speaking and who's funding, follow the money, see what they're looking for and see which case they're promoting to truly understand, well, does that truly make sense, dollars and cents in this case? And are we coming back within the realm of our roadmap in mass, of which we're certainly connected to everybody else, but we need to help the climate. And oh, by the way, we'll need to help, you know, the earth at some point in time, to enable us to continue to live, hopefully, in a safe environment here in mass.
I mean, I think the other interesting word that I think encapsulates a lot of this is, the operating principle or the organizing principle for your society. So when I went to college back when the, you know, TVs were still black and white, yep. I got a National Student Defense Loan to pay for my college.
Yes.
National NDSL loans, right? Mm-hmm. Everything in the 1960s and 70s revolved around fighting the Cold War.
Yes. Right?
That's how you justified everything. Everything yep. was, you know, whatever you want to do is like, well, we got to, you know, fight the Cold War. We're going to do this for that. Right? So fighting communism was the organizing principle of our politics. We say, if you fast forward to the present day, climate change has to be the organizing principle of our politics, right? Mm. And that's how you align all the different groups. And even in Massachusetts, if climate change is the organizing principle of our politics, then slowly all of the bureaucracies in the state, from the DPU to the MBTA to the energy and environment, all that stuff slowly aligns to the same goal, because we're all operating saying that everything has to be, every policy has to be viewed in the context of the climate roadmap. I mean, that helps. So organizing principle is one of the buzzwords I like to throw around.
Yeah, within the overall process. And walking the talk is another piece that I'll throw in there, because certainly as part of my other role in reporting on what's happening with Franklin, I do a lot of reporting by walking around. I'll just walk around town, find out what's happening. And oh, by the way, I'm not driving, so I'm walking and thereby saving some energy that way, and being healthier at the same time. So there's nothing wrong with that part of it. And it gives me some insight, certainly, into the economy, the people, you know, what is going on, and ties into, you know, the overall roadmap. So yeah, there's all pluses there. So without boiling the ocean, I think we've kind of covered the kind of a quick recap, looked a little bit ahead, and then kind of did the deep dive tying in both climate with current events. Anything else specifically that you want to address here? Or obviously, we've already said we can talk for hours on this anyway, so we can save some of it for our next time.
I mean, by next time, there'll be new stuff. I would just point out that the from a roadmap perspective, what we talked about last week, which goes back to building codes, right? Mm. So building codes are a climate issue because the building codes can promote or retard the decarbonization of new houses. So there is a proposed building code that would be more energy efficient that has just gone through a series of hearings before the Department of Energy Resources. What's going to happen now is that will get rewound back, pulled back and revised. And come June or so, I think there'll be another round of hearings about improved building codes for Massachusetts. And so that's just a forward-looking thing that people should be aware of that.
And I think to that point, we touted and at the time we published our interview, the date for comment on that just got extended. So hopefully we'll be able to turn this in time so that they still may be able to submit comments. I think the new date is March 18th. So if you want to go to that extent and comment on that, by all means, we'll include the links in the show notes how to do that through the DOER site, Department of Environmental Energy Resources.
Right.
I've had my seatbelt fastened for this ride, and it's been avoiding some of the bumpy stuff, and we're not completely on the straight path yet. But I appreciate you taking some time today, Ted, to help us make some sense of climate. And I look forward to our next discussion.
My pleasure. I look forward to coming back.
And for those listening, thank you for doing so. And we do this because Franklin matters.
We are now producing this in collaboration with Franklin TV and Franklin Public Radio. This podcast is my public service effort for Franklin, but we can't do it alone. We can always use your help. How can you help? If you can use the information that you find here, please tell your friends and neighbors. If you don't like something here, please let me know. Through this feedback loop, we can continue to make improvements. And I thank you for listening. For additional information, please visit franklinmatters.org. If you have questions or comments, you can reach me directly at suresteve@gmail.com. The music for the intro and exit was provided by Michael Clark and the group East of Shirley. The piece is titled Ernesto Mañana, copyright Michael Clark and Tintype Tunes in 2008. And used with their permission. I hope you enjoy. And by the way, you can also subscribe and listen to Franklin Matters Radio on your favorite podcast app. Search in podcasts for Franklin Matters.
Very cool.